Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Henry Kissinger is back. He's heading the independent commission charged with investigating what went wrong on 9/11. But Kissinger himself has a history that makes critics see red over his record in Cambodia, East Timor, Chile, and Vietnam, not to mention Washington. And Kissinger is now just the most prominent in a long line of ex-Nixon and Reagan-era officials with checkered records now serving in the Bush administration. Otto Reich, John Negroponte, Elliot Abrams, and John Poindexter. It's Iran-Contra Plus in this hour, the return of the outcast Republicans. We begin with a dramatic twist in the Catholic Church crisis at the epicenter of the national uproar over clergy sex abuse. The Boston Archdiocese is reportedly considering filing for bankruptcy. Bankruptcy filings by charitable organizations are rare and unprecedented for the church. Steve Kirchen is a reporter with the Boston Globe investigative team that broke the priest sex abuse story. I asked him to assess how likely it is that the Archdiocese will file for bankruptcy protection.
I think it is a real threat. I don't think it's imminent in the matter of days, but what you have to understand is his advisors, his financial advisors.
This is Cardinal Bernard Law.
Cardinal Bernard Law, who's the bishop of this archdiocese, are unified in their recommendation to him that the archdiocese now go to bankruptcy to end this crisis, to resolve these claims against it.
What might be the allure, the appeal of bankruptcy to the Boston Archdiocese?
First and foremost, I think it ends the daily exposés that are aimed right at the soul of the archdiocese from the release of documents. The lawyers are getting documents released to them by the archdiocese and are making them public by filing them in court. And in those documents, almost uniformly, is another outrage. Not just about the abuse by a priest, but how the archdiocese covered up the claim and didn't remove the priest from his responsibilities.
So if this diocese should go this path, what happens? Does bankruptcy wrap all that up? It all floats down the river in one barge? Does this archdiocese still have to pay out?
It's very important to keep in mind that the archdiocese will have to pay the full amount of these claims. The full amount has yet to be determined, but I have no doubt for several reasons. First, for legal reasons, but more importantly, I think for moral reasons, then it may be more than $100 million. They will get 20, 30, 40, maybe even $50 million from their two major insurance companies that covered it and their priests during these time periods, which is probably be during the mid-50s to late 80s. But the remainder will have to come from the archdiocese, and the archdiocese will have to sell their property to make up the remainder.
Steve Kirchen, you've reported that the archdiocese in Boston has property valued at over $1.3 billion, perhaps substantially over that. We're looking at a liability from claims here of maybe $100 million. How can they, I guess is the question, declare bankruptcy if their assets are so much greater than these liabilities?
Well, that's a good question, and the legal reason is that the archdiocese at this point says all that property is outside of the reach of lawyers, that property is held by the archdiocese, not all of it, but 90% of it, is held in trust with the individual parishes. Even though the archdiocese can be sued, that those properties, since they're held in trust by the archdiocese with the individual parishes, they cannot be reached. So as you look at the claims against it and what it owns solely by itself, It shows that the $100 million plus, which is the potential amount, is more than what they own outright by itself. However, the sole proprietor of this archdiocese is one man, the cardinal. And even though those properties are held in trust in some legal documents, there's one person who owns it, and that's the cardinal. He has the ability to alienate, which is the legal term or the canonical term, alienate those properties and gain the proceeds and pay off these victims' claims.
Steve Kirchen, if the Boston Catholic Church should go down this path, is this likely to set a pattern that other dioceses may follow?
That it's a possibility, but I think that the bishops think first and foremost of the reputation of the diocese and also its fundraising people are going to think long and hard about giving to an institution that is in bankruptcy. So unless it fits its particular financial need as badly as it does the Boston's Archdiocese, I doubt if it will gain momentum. You have to keep in mind Boston Archdiocese is facing more than 400 claims of clergy sexual abuse. That's more than we know of in the other diocese and archdiocese.
After everything that's come out in the last year and more, what is it that the church is afraid will still come out? Why is it worth such a drastic step to avoid more depositions and more information coming out? Isn't most of what's there on the table already?
Well, the news reporter in me says no, that we still don't have a clear understanding as to why the church did what it did and why they did it uniformly across the country.
That is, why did they cover up and reassign priests who had been abusing children?
Yes. Why, and when they first started to gain some attention in the 50s and 60s, and early 70s, when bishops became aware that this was a problem, why didn't they call the police? Why didn't they go to the parishioners and say, we've got a problem here, we're embarrassed by it, we're mortified by it, but we're first and foremost, we're going to protect you, and we're going to alert you to the problem. And what my suggestion is, there's a document somewhere, there's a contact somewhere, there's a source somewhere that says, this is the reason why, and this is why they all did it the same way. We haven't come up with that understanding. The cautionary flag in me, as a reporter, tells me also that it was almost natural that the code of silence is very strong in every profession, and you don't want to bring scandal upon your religious organization.
So are you suggesting that it might have been some order that went out to handle these cases in this way, or that there's something relating to the character of some high-ranking official that would be unbearable to make public?
Yes, I'm thinking that it may have been some sort of order that went out, and therefore it was intentional. It wasn't just a blind eye. It wasn't, but it was a weighing of the pros and cons for going in this way, for, quote, covering up, unquote. And they went that way. And the reporter in me says that the only way that that's going to come out is by through the legal process that's been ongoing, but so devastating and detrimental to the integrity and the reputation of the cardinal and the church. And if they can buy their way out of this financially and hold their head high and saying the victims have been repaired as much as they can be repaired, we're willing to pay their counseling, we're willing to pay the full freight on their settlement fees, but please, let's be done with it. Let's get on with the good things, all the good things that this church does, and let us go back to that mission.
And bankruptcy might close the door on that. Steve Kirchen, thanks very much for joining us. Stephen Kirchen is a reporter with the Boston Globe and co-author of Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. He spoke with me earlier from Boston. Depending on your politics, the list of Bush administration appointees is starting to read like a most wanted poster for the biggest political scandals of the Nixon-Reagan years, or a lineup of besmirched and resurrected good soldiers. Otto Reich, Assistant Secretary for Latin American Affairs, Elliot Abrams, a Senior Director, National Security Council, and John Poindexter, Director of the Total Information Awareness Project, all had ties to Iran-Contra. UN Ambassador John Negroponte channeled aid to the Contras through backroom deals, and Henry Kissinger, now head of an independent 9/11 commission, has been accused of supporting terrorists and secret wars of his own. Is outrage over the return of Kissinger just a liberal hissy fit, as the New York Times' William Sapphire says? Or is Iran-Contra plus this crew a minor astonishment? What's the Bush administration worldview that happily brings back men once branded as rogues? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation. Good evening and welcome, David Korn.
Good to be with you.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So, David Korn, who's got it right? William Sapphire says the critics, maybe including yourself, are just having a hissy fit over the return of Henry Kissinger. I don't know if he extends that to the rest of the Iran-Contra crew that's on board with Bush, too. But how serious is it that we see all these names, Kissinger and then through the kind of Iran-Contra quartet, back in the middle of a new White House in 2002?
Well, listen, I'm happy to talk about the big issue about how the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, has turned into one big Iran-Contra rehab unit for these folks of the past. But sticking with Kissinger for the moment, which is, I think, the most outrageous of these various appointments. And Bill Safire has been a strong critic of Kissinger in the past, and he's for some reason making nice with him now. But in any event, you have an independent commission, supposed to be independent commission, that's supposed to look at what went wrong on and before September 11th. And that has to do with, you know, secrets within the government, maybe some routine matters as well. And Henry Kissinger, whatever you believe of him, whether you believe he's a war criminal or not, whether you believe he should go to jail for having an illegal bombing in Cambodia and for trying to actually helping succeed in the overthrow of Chile in the 70s and actually backing terroristic governments in Chile and Argentina where they were kidnapping, murdering political opponents and such, whether you, you know, think that's important or not, one thing's undeniable, and that is Henry Kissinger is not known for getting to the bottom of government malfeasance or nonfeasance. He's a guy who'd rather keep secrets than reveal secrets. His whole career to date has not been one of an advertisement for open government, and he has also proven in various serious matters to be a liar. One good example is that for years, he claimed that when he and President Ford, when he was Secretary of State in 1975, visited Indonesia. They happened to be there the day before Indonesia brutally invaded East Timor. Mm-hmm. They claim that they had no idea what was coming, and they gave no advance permission or
no green light
to Suharto, who was the dictator of Indonesia at the time, the military dictator. Well, last year, a document came out, a U.S. State Department cable, classified all these years, that sort of details the conversation they have, in which they clearly were told by Suharto he may have to take drastic steps, and they clearly said, well, you do what you have to do. We understand. We, you know, you have our blessing, tacit blessing.
So in retrospect, it does look like there was a green light there.
No, it was a clear green light. And so here's the guy who's proven to be a liar on serious matters and has no reputation for getting into, you know, disclosure issues, and he's been given the task of running an independent commission that's supposed to serve the public and serve the family members of those who perished in 9/11 and get to the bottom of some of the questions that linger and give us a full accounting.
We're going to look at whether or not Henry Kissinger might have turned over a new leaf, if that's at all possible, but take us on through the bill of particulars that you've laid out here, David Korn. Vietnam.
Vietnam. Well, there are several items there. I mean, one is before he even took office in 1968, the Nixon campaign was trying to undermine the Paris peace talks. They didn't want Johnson to succeed with a, you know, with some breakthrough right close to the election. And Kissinger, who had actually worked for Nelson Rockefeller in the primaries against Nixon, wanted to get in good with the Nixon people, and he more or less spied on the Democrats who were doing the peace talks in Paris. He knew some of them from Harvard and such, and he gave these reports back to Nixon, to his campaign, and the Nixon people used that to try to scuttle or at least obstruct those negotiations. But once he got in power, once he got into office with Nixon, first as National Security Advisor and then as Secretary of State, he was, you know, one of the co-architects of Nixon's strategy in Vietnam, and that included overseeing the secret bombing campaign in Cambodia. That was one of the articles of impeachment that was then dropped, but it was arguably an illegal operation declaring war in Cambodia without even telling Congress.
And very quickly, the Chile story.
Chile, in the early 70s, Kissinger, at Nixon's behest, it wasn't his own doing, oversaw the CIA's extensive covert campaign that was trying to assist the coup plotters who wanted to overthrow the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. The problem was Allende was a socialist. They didn't like that. And indeed, they succeeded in helping foment an environment in which in 1973, Allende was overthrown and the murderous dictatorship of Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, came in. And after that, Kissinger was a supporter of Pinochet. And according to, again, new documents just out, in 76, at the height of Pinochet's repression, remember, thousands of people have been disappeared, which we now know means that they were kidnapped and murdered and thrown into the ocean and such. At the height of that, Kissinger had a meeting with Pinochet behind closed doors, and he told him, quote, "We are sympathetic to what you are trying to do here." That's encouraging a known terrorist.
And we haven't even touched on Argentina, on Bangladesh. There's a long list here, and it rides with Henry Kissinger. In a word, we've just got 10 seconds. Has this man changed?
I see no reason why he hasn't made any public confessions.
Well, we haven't seen a public confession, but we've got a very public position now for Henry Kissinger, and he's not the only Republican returnee. We're talking tonight about Kissinger, Poindexter, and the one-time rogue Republicans back in the Bush administration. Are you surprised, pleased, outraged to see Henry Kissinger back in the saddle, heading a truth commission? Is Admiral John Poindexter the man you want running Total Information Awareness in Washington, inspecting your credit card bills? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Henry Kissinger, about John Poindexter, and the one-time rogue Republicans now in the Bush 2 administration. Why has the Bush administration brought back so many controversial characters from the Republican past? Are these unfairly tainted men, too good to be ignored in a national time of trial? Or are they rascals and rogues resurrected from the darker shadows of Iran-Contra and the Nixon administration? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is David Korn. He's Washington editor of The Nation. And Jack Beatty, you've been listening as well. We looked a little bit at Henry Kissinger there, but he's not the only guy who's been brought back. He's not the only one with a fairly or unfeigned, a tainted record that's back in this White House.
No, he's not. And you have to ask why. I think that the war on terror has given Bush a kind of Teflon coat, that he can make appointments, that he can do things on tax policy with immunity that he would not have had on September 10th. There's just been no heat for any of these things. And on the other hand, he's gotten a gain from them. I mean, by appointing an Abrams, he's the son-in-law of the leading neoconservative intellectual Norman Podoretz. He's a close friend of William Kristol. He's a sort of central neoconservative figure. Poindexter is a kind of totem to people on the right, a hero for having taken a bullet for President Reagan in the Iran-Contra affair. Indeed, Reagan himself said to Ollie North, "Ollie, you're a national hero." Well, that's the outlook, I think, about Poindexter. Otto Reich is a tied in with the Cuban Americans in Miami, and according to a recent New Yorker article, helped to persuade the first Bush administration to give sanctuary in America, in Miami, to a terrorist, to a Cuban doctor who had been instrumental in bombing a Cuban airliner. So he gets something from his base with these people, and he doesn't seem to pay from the opposition. There isn't one. Or from the public at large, who just seem to think none of these things matter.
But David Korn, I wonder if this is not in some sense par for the course. We've flipped from a Democratic period to a Republican period. Sapphire points out today that FDR appointed Joseph Kennedy as first chairman of the SEC because that predator, as he calls him, knew all the manipulative tricks. Bush chose Kissinger because the old operator can see through the secret obfuscations he mastered long ago. Is this just the right of a returning party, returning to power, to bring back people that it sees as having been unfairly tarnished?
Well, to the victor goes the spoils. I mean, that's certainly true. And Jack makes some good points. And a lot of these guys, though, were appointed prior to September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot Abrams was appointed in June of 2001. And at that point, Otto Reich and John Negroponte, who had been involved in Iran-Contra, had already gotten their high-level appointments, too. I think you got to look at, I mean, I think the Kennedy, I'm not going to defend, Joseph Kennedy Sr. here, I mean, even for people at Boston Public Radio, but you got to look at what we're talking about. Elliot Abrams pled guilty to misdemeanor counts of lying to Congress. He didn't have to do time, but he pled guilty. That means he admitted that he had lied to the Congress.
And so later pardoned by George Bush Sr.
He was pardoned. But, I mean, it doesn't change the facts of what happened. Poindexter was convicted of five felony counts, including obstruction and lying to Congress as well. Now, he was sentenced to 6 months. He was the conviction was overturned in what, a lot of conservatives would say one of those legal technicalities, because of the way Congress used his testimony when he appeared before the Iran-Contra hearings. It was a question of immunization, not anything about what he did or did not do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're looking at people who are who were convicted or at least it's clear, on the record that they have been liars and they lied to Congress, then that's, you know, that's pretty damn bad. And if you're looking at Kissinger and hoping that maybe this is, you know, pun intended, a Nixon going to China type of deal, that, you know, only, you know, Henry Kissinger could bring us the truth, well, that's really a Hail Mary type of view of things. Because, you know, the guy is in his late 70s. He's shown nothing except secrecy through his entire career. Even when he left office, he managed to hang on to a lot of public records that were generated when he was an official, claim them as his own, and wouldn't share them with anybody else, with historians and journalists, and use them to his own benefit in writing his own memoirs and gaining financially.
He's a changed man, William Safire says. He's learned from his mistakes. Stand by, David Korn. I want to welcome some more voices into our conversation. Michael Ledeen is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and joining us from Washington. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Ledeen.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And from Summerland, California, Luke Cannon, veteran journalist and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post, author of several books about Ronald Reagan, including President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. Good evening and welcome, Luke Cannon.
Good to be with you.
Luke Cannon, it may be that not all of our listeners were even around and paying attention during Iran-Contra. Take us back through this handful of Iran-Contra names that have resurfaced in George Bush 2, if you will. One by one, in a nutshell, who were they, what did they do, and how do they look now? Do they look like they're clean enough to be respectably back in a new administration?
Well, Tom, I have to tell you that whenever the people on the right lumped everybody, liberals, McGovernites, whatever phrase they wanted to use, as peas in a pod, I objected. And I sort of object to this, this lumping. John Negroponte was involved, allegedly. He, unlike the others, wasn't ever convicted of anything, for helping the Contras in as U.S. ambassador to Honduras. On the other hand, he's a very respected diplomat, Holbrooke, and he was used in the Clinton administration, said good things about him, and I think he's an obvious legitimate appointment.
Well, this is exactly the kind of thing we want you to help us sort out, Luke Cannon.
Yeah,
so you'd give Negroponte a clean pass.
Yeah,
here.
I don't know why I give him a clean pass. I mean, who of us has a clean pass? But I think Negroponte is a respectable appointment. Reich is clearly a sop to the right wing, as your news analyst said, on Cuba. I mean, he's
currently Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs.
He's always been on one side of the issue. He's a former lobbyist for Bacardi Rum. He's clearly a signal. David Corn's right to point out these guys were appointed before September 11th. Mm-hmm. He's clearly a signal that this administration does not want any kind of a rapprochement with Cuba.
And is there a lasting taint there from Iran-Contra, or was it something that's been duly noted and found to be acceptable?
I don't think with Reich the question is much Iran-Contra as the fact that he is so completely on one side, the right wing side of that debate, at a time that all kinds of countries are taking a new look at Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Now, had a problem too. He had his own run-in with improper behavior when he was in the State Department during the Iran-Contra affair. He was cited by a GAO report as having engaged, this is their quote, engaged in prohibited covert propaganda.
David Korn got that.
He wrote stuff for Exiles and put it in under his name. I don't think there's any question that he did that.
Elliot Abrams, Luke Cannon.
Elliot Abrams, I don't know whether one should be forgiving to Mr. Abrams or not. I think I'd be inclined to. There's absolutely no question that he lied to Congress. But I don't think the transcendent appointment to me here, from my standpoint, much worse even than Kissinger, is Poindexter.
How so?
Poindexter, he not only was he convicted of these five felonies, but Poindexter consistently dissembled and lied and ran an operation that was he was Oliver North's boss. If you believe Walsh's report, which did clear Reagan, he said Reagan, Walsh said there is no credible evidence that Reagan knew of the diversion, then then the highest person who knew the diversion is Poindexter.
And just to review the facts of the case, this was the diversion of
this was money that was received from secret and illegal sales of arms to Iran that was diverted to the Nicaraguan rebels known as the Contras.
So in hopes of getting hostages out of Iran and getting money to the Contras in Nicaragua.
Yeah, people have forgotten all of this stuff, but a relatively small part of that money actually went to the Contras. A lot of it went into the pockets of the people like Secord and the people who profiteered from it. But I think that the North appointment is, I mean, the Poindexter appointment is I think it's really an affront because here is a guy who I don't dislike Poindexter personally. In fact, I like him personally. But here is a man who never showed once in office any respect for the Constitution. He doesn't believe that people have a right to know what's going on. The thought of putting him in charge of a program where he's making recommendations on scooping
up mountains of information about Americans
is mind-boggling.
He will head up this new agency, the Information Awareness Office. Yeah. Lou Cannon, stand by. I want to bring Michael Ledeen in here. Michael Ledeen was special advisor to the Secretary of State from 1981 to 82 and national security advisor to President Reagan, 82 to 86. He's author of The War Against the Terror Masters. Michael Ledeen, you may have a different view of this. We're trying to sort out what's what in the crew that's been brought in from that period, and what the Bush administration worldview is that sees this as not just okay, but very worthy and something to be gunned for.
Yeah, well, I have a kind of maverick view on all of this stuff. I mean, I have disagreements with many of these people, serious disagreements with John Poindexter and Elliot Abrams and so forth. But I think it's a mistake and a distraction, frankly, to what the public debate ought to be, to focus on the alleged illegalities and again, to try to criminalize this kind of behavior when the real crime in Iran-Contra was policy. It was an idiotic policy.
So this is the Republican argument that we just simply had things wrong in the mid-'80s. These guys were trying to fight a wrong-headed tide out of Washington, and more glory to them for it.
Well, I don't know. Various Republicans have different views of it, and different Democrats have different views of it. I'm not sure it's a Republican or a Democratic view. My own feeling is that we ought to try not to criminalize behavior simply because we disagree with it. I mean, I heard Lou Cannon say that the weapon sales to Iran were illegal. But no one was ever prosecuted for illegal weapon sales, and in fact, it turned out they weren't illegal. They were perfectly. I mean, they were stupid.
Now, Michael Ledeen, you actually had some kind of role in all this. Describe that to us.
I was an advisor to the National Security Council in those years, and I was the National Security Council person who attended the early meetings between the American government, the Israeli government, and various Iranians. And I too had Judge Walsh for many years, and I too got the same treatment as the president and others got, which is, that nobody could find that I did anything wrong, and they grudgingly had to say, well, if he did something wrong, we can't find it, which is the best you could get in those years.
But your point here is a kind of pragmatic point that it might or might not have been against the law, but it was a wrong-headed policy that was being fought, and let's not leave a taint on these men forever because of it.
It was a terrible policy, and it seems to me the question that we should be asking about people in government is, are they smart or are they stupid? I mean, are they inclined to do bad things or are they inclined to do good things?
There's also a question of whether they're honest or not, and these are not alleged illegalities.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is that regardless of what the policy was, whether the policy was bright or dumb as a fence post, they lied to Congress about it. Elie Abrams pled guilty to lying, and that's not an alleged illegality. John Poindexter was convicted of 5 felonies. This has to do with honesty and whether we can trust these people to do right with the power they have by being in office.
Lou Cannon, speak to that.
I suspect if you...
Lou Cannon in California, come in here. How do you sort this out?
Well, I suspect if you disbarred everybody from office who's ever told a lie to Congress, you'd reduce the universe of public appointees by quite a bit.
And yet we can't be quite that clear, can we?
My objection to Poindexter is not that he that he was convicted, and they shouldn't ever appoint somebody who was convicted to something, even if he got off for it. My objection to Poindexter is that there's absolutely no sign. I'd be interested if Michael Ledeen had a different view of this, but there's absolutely no sign ever from Poindexter that he realized or even confessed that the policy in which he engaged was stupid, or that he has changed his mind at all about public information.
Michael Ledeen, is John Poindexter a changed man?
Well, not so far as I can tell, and I didn't like the policy. I mean, I've been one of the most outspoken critics of that policy. But again, the issue, it seems to me, ought to be, I mean, what scares me about what Poindexter's doing is not that it's Poindexter who's doing it, but that it is being done. And the debate that we need to have in this country is whether we want any government agency with anybody, St. Francis of Assisi, in charge of the agency, collecting endless information about the entire American public, and then what are the checks and controls on it, and so forth.
Michael Ledeen, let me ask you this. Out of all the people in all the world, all the smart people in the United States, why is it that the Bush administration has pulled these men up? Aren't there plenty of other folks who are competent, smart, tuned in? Why these guys?
Oh, I'm sure there's a million people who are smart and could do any of these jobs. But I think there's a part of this that, there is a wing of the Republican Party that thinks all these people, a lot of these people, were treated terribly, and that they want to be kosherized in some sense. They want to make a gesture. And I think sometimes it's not a bad idea to do that, and sometimes it's a terrible idea. But I think I still think that the focus of this discussion and of the national discussion of this and other questions ought to be on policy. I mean, the issue about Henry Kissinger, for example, I mean, Henry Kissinger is such a big figure that he's done endless terrible things and endless good things. So we can spend hours and hours talking about why we don't like him and why we do like him. I mean, the interesting thing about Kissinger's career, I think, if you look at it, is that he has always been extremely suspicious of the intelligence agencies. And he didn't like CIA, and he didn't trust CIA. And from that standpoint, he might be a good chairman of this commission.
We're going to come back and look at that. Is that you, Lou?
Yes.
Yes. Last word, Lou.
I just want to say that I don't think I've ever said anything good about Henry Kissinger in my life, but he did a really good job as chairman of the Commission on Central America, which is something in which he wasn't involved. And this is something in which he isn't involved, so conceivably he'd do a good job on this, too.
Well, we'll see. Lou Cannon, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Lou Cannon is former White House correspondent for The Washington Post and author of President Reagan, The Role of a Lifetime. And Michael Ledeen, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Michael Ledeen is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Jack Beatty, Michael Ledeen says, let's not focus on the characters, on the history. Let's focus on policy and what we need right now. Don't look back.
Yeah, and let's focus on the purpose of the commission. I think we have to ask about the Kissinger appointment, the Lenin's question, who benefits? And I think the person who benefits is the person who apparently pushed hardest for Kissinger. That's Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney was given the portfolio of heading up a terrorism, anti-terrorism group in the White House and didn't hold a single meeting. So he's got a lot to hide, it seems to me, and Mr. Kissinger, I suspect, will hide it.
We're talking tonight about Henry Kissinger, John Poindexter, and the one-time rogue Republicans now in the Bush administration. You can join us. Is there a statute of limitations on rapscallion status? And worse, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Kissinger, Poindexter, and the one-time rogue Republicans back in the Bush administration. Are you surprised, pleased, outraged to see Henry Kissinger back in the saddle, heading a truth commission? And is this a Republican whitewash or bringing back the A-team? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight is David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation. And right now calling is Adam. Welcome, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I have sort of a two-part comment question.
Give it to us quick, Adam. We've got your radio in the background, so lay it on us.
One of your early guests, Michael Ledeen, was saying that he thinks that the issue should be the policy rather than the appointees.
Right here, right now.
Exactly. And what I was wondering is if maybe that might actually be a calculated strategy on the part of the Bush administration, is that by throwing out these incredibly polarized appointees, they are deliberately deflecting the debate. because they know, and then that way they can sort of say, oh, well, you know, and maybe they can back off a little bit.
Deflecting it where? You're saying that they're not going to follow the policies recommended by these men?
No. I beg your pardon. But that, like, for instance, take Poindexter's appointment, that by appointing someone so controversial, they are able to direct the debate to should or should not Poindexter be the man rather than should this even exist, as Mr. Levine was saying. And that way it never comes up whether or not this is an appropriate agency, an appropriate policy, because all of the people who would normally be opponents are directing their energies towards protesting Mr. Poindexter.
Got it. Adam, we've got it. I want to put it to David Korn. Thanks for your call. David Korn, do you see that? Do you see that level of kickback?
I think Adam's giving them too much credit mm-hmm. there. I mean, I agree with Michael Ledeen that, you know, the issues are what's going on now, but I also believe, and he's not with us now, but mm-hmm. people in Washington who've been in Washington long enough, who've covered Washington, know that personnel makes policy. And after all, it was not Al Gore, who campaigned on the platform of restoring honor and integrity to the White House. That was part of George W. Bush's campaign platform. He said it over and over again. I don't see how you restore honor and integrity by putting people there who have demonstrated an inability to tell the truth about controversial policies. So, yes, we should be debating what Poindexter is doing with the Total Information Awareness Project, mm-hmm. but we also should be worried that a fellow who doesn't have a record as a truth teller, we should be worried whether he is or is not leveling with us or Congress about what it is they're actually doing.
Jack Beatty, you earlier were describing this as a kind of payback and currying of favors with these appointments, but these are not trifling positions. These are important positions that will result in policy that will have major impact on American government and life.
It's true, and I, for one, am just frightened at someone of Poindexter's character in that particular job, where he's going to have access to the credit card records and all sorts of information about ordinary American citizens. What we saw in Iran-Contra about Poindexter was that he was a man for whom the end justified any means, and that's just exactly the kind of person we don't want. With information about private citizens. We don't know, for example, whether this man would use that information for political purposes, whether the administration through him has got a sort of access into people's records that might help them in pressuring people. Who knows? But it's just a kind of insult, I think, to the public to put somebody who has so little sense of ethics of government ethics, of the public good, in a position that where that would seem to be crucial.
But David Korn, if it's not just payback and currying favor, maybe this is an expression of Bush administration policy. Maybe it's the time, they believe, for men who believe ends justify means. We've got a war on terror to fight here.
That's true, but I have to believe that if you're going to put someone in the National Security Committee Council mm-hmm. staff in the White House mm-hmm. to work on democracy and human rights abroad, that of all the people who could do that job, you probably can find somebody who wasn't convicted of lying to Congress and who didn't spend much of the 80s denying that there were human rights abuses going on in Guatemala and El Salvador committed by militaries that were being supported by the Reagan administration. That is what Elliot Abrams did. So by picking him, they are clearly sending a signal to the neoconservatives. They are clearly saying we're making up for the arrows that he took in service to Ronald Reagan back in the 80s. And it is highly symbolic, and I think there's some of that with Poindexter. Poindexter has spent a lot of the last few years working on technology issues, and he's probably somewhat qualified for the job. But to overlook these other issues that Jack just raised, I think in some ways it comes out of arrogance, out of hubris, out of the president saying, my way or any way. And I think that goes doubly, if not tenfold, for the Kissinger appointment.
A kind of triumphalism. Of course, Michael Ledeen was pretty upfront when he was with us saying, yes, this is a kind of rehabilitation of men who they see as having been done wrong. Alexis is calling. Hi, Alexis. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling because I'd like to take a serious objection to some comments that have already been made on the show by some of your guests.
All right.
Basically, it's excuses on behalf of people accused of crimes in office. First we heard who among us has a clean pass after all? And then there's something about if everyone who ever lied to Congress was convicted, you know, we'd
be nobody in Congress.
You know, that's just absolutely outrageous. Is it the case that Americans are just corrupt and shameless people with nobody trustworthy to represent us, you know?
So you're not willing to have that kind of malleable, flexible, come back and do better this time attitude?
Absolutely not. I mean, if people can be locked up for decades for, you know, selling, you know, a crack on the street to, you know, feed the family or whatever it is, you know, why is it that these people get to get... I like the slogan of the people in Argentina, you know, marching in the streets, starving and whatnot. They say, que se vayan todos, you know, that they should all go. We don't want any of these people in office because they're in there just to line their pockets. And, you know, we're quite capable of governing ourselves.
Alexis, we've got it. David Korn?
Didn't we spend several years having a big debate in this country about honoring the White House and what message it sends when the president lies? Or what else does
Well, but the president's not lying. He's appointing these people in the clear light of day, and he's saying these are the men I want.
He appoints people who are liars, who are known liars, as Jack and Lou and I all say about Poindexter and Elliot Abrams. These are known liars. You can prove Henry Kissinger lies as well, regardless of whether you think he was wonderful in detente and opening up to China. And so what does it say about a president who, you know, who wants to restore honor and integrity to the White House when he resorts to picking liars? I think it's incredibly cynical on the part of anyone to say that we can't have honesty in government.
Let's get one more call. Alan's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening.
I see if this is whitewash, and yes, the A-team is back. I have grave concerns about this because a lot of balls were dropped before this terrorist attack.
9/11.
A lot of loose ends, and I could see them forfeiting the game right here. So I just see this cover-up after cover-up. And the other extreme of it, you know, if a person were to be investigated, an innocent person, they could be severely discredited because of this, because they're going to be harassment, wiretaps, you name it.
We're talking about information awareness. Alan, we're running out of time, but thank you for your call. Jack Beatty, is this a pattern that's been repeated through American history, that when a party returns in triumph, it brings back the soldiers, its soldiers, that took arrows that they thought were unjustified under previous administrations? Or is this a new level of kind of ahistorical appointment?
Off the top of my head, I just can't come up with anything. I mean, I'm thinking of after when Eisenhower came in, he didn't go back to the Hoover administration or you know, Warren Harding's time to bring back some of their rummer characters. So it does seem to me to bespeak a kind of consciousness that I think the Bush administration has, which is basically history is bunk, which is basically that the public is numb to all this stuff, which is anything that's more than three sentences deep, we don't worry about it, which is, hey, we're fighting a war here and you're quibbling about the credentials of these people. Get real. I think that's the overall attitude here.
David Cohen, we just got 20 seconds left, but we don't really hear a national uproar about this.
No, we've seen the L.A. Times and the New York Times and myself and Jack and others raise a fuss about the Kissinger appointment. But when there is this overarching war on terrorism, when they're beating the drums about war in Iraq, I can understand why, you know, the average person at home may not focus on this. And I agree with Jack. You know, the Bush people know they can get away with this. They do this on holiday vacations, holiday weekends. And
David Korn, with that, we've got to go. But I want to thank you for joining us. David Korn is Washington editor of The Nation. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, President Bush expresses skepticism on the weapons inspections in Iraq. This is On Point. Weapons inspectors spent 6 hours today combing through a ballistic design plant in Baghdad looking for illegal missiles. It was their most extensive search since inspections began last week. At the end of the day, the UN reported that some equipment was missing, but Iraq says the equipment was either moved or destroyed by U.S. attacks. Meanwhile, President Bush spoke from the Pentagon about the weapons inspectors' progress at a signing ceremony for the 2003 defense spending bill. Bush warned that the signs coming from Iraq are not encouraging. Here is an excerpt of what the president had to say.
In the inspections process, the United States will be making one judgment. Has Saddam Hussein changed his behavior of the last 11 years? Has he decided to cooperate willingly and comply completely, or has he not? So far, the signs are not encouraging. A regime that fires upon American and British pilots is not taking the path of compliance. A regime that sends letters filled with protests and falsehoods is not taking the path of compliance. On or before the 8th of December, Iraq must provide a full and accurate declaration of its weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs. That declaration must be credible and complete, or the Iraqi dictator will have demonstrated to the world once again that he has chosen not to change his behavior. Americans seek peace in this world. We're a peaceful nation. War is the last option for confronting threats. Yet the temporary peace of denial and looking away from danger would only be a prelude to broader war and greater horror. America will confront gathering dangers early, before our options become limited and desperate. By showing our resolve today, we're building a future of peace. In the decisions and missions to come, our military will carry the values of America and the hopes of the world. The people of Iraq, like all human beings, deserve their freedom.
President Bush speaking during a signing ceremony for the 2003 defense spending bill earlier today. Jack Beatty, there has been speculation, maybe hope, that the inspectors would actually solve this problem. But the president here, brick by brick, appears to be continuing to build the case for war.
And yet we read over the weekend that the inspectors were satisfied thus far at the progress they've made. And we read in today's New York Times some inspectors saying, do the Americans really want us to succeed? And it turns out that the Americans have not even given the inspectors some of the information they have, the secret information, about secret weapons projects. So the inspectors aren't even being informed of what our government knows.
But isn't that fair in a way at this point, Jack, because Iraq's supposed to voluntarily lay all this down by December 8th?
Well, I know, but it does show an ominous distance, it seems to me, between the inspectors and our government. And the question, I think, all along has been, are we serious about these inspections, or is this just a kind of public relations stunt then that we're willing to say, no, it won't work?
Of course, the other question is Iraq serious about disarming, which it's supposed to do voluntarily?
It sure is, and we may know as early as Thursday, apparently, with a 1,000-page report they're going to give, whether that's candid or not. We'll have to see.
We heard President Bush in his words saying the U.S. will decide, not the U.N.
Well, there are other parties to this, too, the U.N. as well, and I think that's where the complications come in.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBUR.